Welcome to a new episode, and this will be the most massive episode ever, as we will be talking in trillions of dollars. Not just trillions in asset under management, but trillions saved for investors, trillions more in our pockets. And it all comes from a movement started by one man who's a titan of the industry, Jack Bogle. And to discuss it with me, I have a titan of the ETF analysis, Eric Balchunas from Bloomberg, and the author of The Bogle Effect. Eric, it's great to have you here. Thank you for joining me.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So it may sound very obvious who Bogle was for people in the industry. Your book is full of quotes, and he's a hero, a legend for many people. But somehow I wonder if, especially from a European perspective, if he's got the same presence in people's minds. So could we just start with a reminder of who's Jack Bogle and what did he do?
Yeah, it's interesting because in the US, he's much more known, although not that known. I've had people inside the industry call it the Bogle effect, like didn't even really know how to pronounce his name. And it's just fascinating to me because I don't really think any other human being will have had a bigger impact on investors. Point blank, that's it, bottom line. We can put that aside for a second. I think in Europe, it gets even trickier because he was predominantly in the US physically his whole life. He was really, Vanguard was a US only company for a long time. They opened an office in Australia pretty early, but they were a little late going overseas. BlackRock went over a lot quicker. And then we had a passive movement go across the world, but not quite as fast as in the US. So A, he wasn't there. B, the passive and low cost thing hasn't spread into Europe as quickly. And I go into this in the book. There's a couple of reasons. I think it's a market where the intermediaries still like to get paid as a commission from the mutual fund as opposed to being fiduciaries. And a lot of the population isn't necessarily pushed into being their own fund analyst. Like in the US, everybody's in 401k plans, has to learn what funds are, and has to have a little knowledge. Europe, it's not quite like that. Like people are a little more laid back about it. And that, I think, is why higher costs and active funds have remained bigger in other parts of the world and why Bogle would be less known. However, over the next few decades, I believe all this will sort of shape like the US. And so in that front, I think ultimately he'll be more known because passive will be more known in the rest of the world. But that's also why I wrote the book. The fact that he isn't that known, I thought, well, I opened the book with a story about this millennial publication that riffed off of a column I wrote about how he saved $1 trillion. And the headline was like, some guy you've never heard of saved us all billions of dollars. And I just thought, it's true. Nobody heard of this guy. So I thought there was an opening to fill that gap with that. So in the US, if people haven't heard of, it's even less in Europe. So hopefully this book just finds its way into the right people's hands over the years. I didn't expect it to like sweep the New York Times bestseller list, but I expected it to have legs and endure time. And I think it is. It's already, year and a half old, but it's exactly, like there's nothing really I'd change about it. I think it's one of these things that will last a while. It's not trendy. And so I think writing about this guy was something I could just be proud of and just get out there. And then hopefully over time, people can learn about him or his low-fee philosophy whenever they are ready to.
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed, I worked in ETF myself. I was doing the DX trackers in the Origin. Then I was a source that became Invesco. So that's a decade ago. And I have to admit, back then, I didn't have Bogle or Vanguard very much in my mind. Now that I've studied a bit more, I am a fan. I'm a Boglehead. I quote him often in the podcast, but yes, it's something that's not that obvious until you really understand what happened. And to go to the main impact, and you mentioned it, these trillions of dollars saved. Could you run us through without the calculation, but how did you come up to that number?
Yeah, it's a pretty blunt calculation, and I'll give it to you this way. So if you're in an active mutual fund, generally speaking, you're going to pay 2% fees. 1% is the management fee to the company, the expense ratio. I think you call it TER or MER in Europe, but it's that fee that goes to running the fund, paying the portfolio manager. Then another percent generally into trading. When a portfolio manager trades the stocks and has to try to jockey its way into trying to get some outperformance, those trades cost money. I was even somewhat generous in my calculation. I said, okay, let's look at the asset weighted average expense ratio. It's 66 basis points. So it's not quite 1%, it's 66. And let's look at the exact average turnover, and it's more like 50. So it's basically 110 basis points, 1.1%. Vanguard has an asset weighted fee of 9 basis points. I think it's 8 this year. It keeps coming down. So if you take, and if you look at their asset weighted fee over time, and the number I just gave you, 110, because that was higher earlier. If you just look at those and you multiply that by the assets Vanguard has, those assets would otherwise be in the higher cost funds. If you just multiply that in the difference, that's where you get about $1 trillion over the course of Vanguard's life. But that number grows by $150 billion a year. So we're going to quickly get it $2, $3 trillion pretty quickly. And the $150 billion grows. So obviously there's inflation in these numbers, and a billion isn't what it used to be. But that is a lot of money that essentially, if goes back, that money would have been, that's not just assets, okay? That's actual revenue that would have been in Wall Street that is now with end investors. And it's the formula looks at Vanguard, but then it also looks at their impact on other funds. So for example, BlackRock and Schwab also have very dirt cheap funds. I contend in the book, there's no way these companies would be at 4 or 5 basis points of a fee if there's no Vanguard. They might cut a little. Every business has cost competition, but I think they'd be more like 50, 40. That would be where we'd be at with a no Vanguard. But they're down to 4 or 5, even less, because Vanguard's there. So they've been vanguarded, if you will. They had to get cheap. When they get cheap, they get money. So there's a direct correlation. Once a fund company goes cheap and tries to compete with Vanguard, the flows come. So they like, oh, well, that worked. So you have this Vanguard itself, and then you have the Vanguard effect. And that's part of why I called the book the Bogle effect, because about half of the number of the trillion is from them impacting other companies. And this is a really important point, because one of the most fascinating quotes in the book that was a quote I'd never heard from Bogle. Bogle's like Ben Franklin. He's got a bunch of quotes people know about, like, but don't search for the needle in the haystack, just buy the haystack. There's about 5 or 6 quotes that people generally know Bogle said. He's like Buffett in that way. But I was reading one of his lesser known books when I was researching this book, and I found something in there that blew my mind, that he said to his crew, the employees, this is in 1991, that he would know that Vanguard's mission was beginning to be fulfilled when Vanguard's market share began to erode. And to me, that is powerful stuff, because A, what CEO has ever rooted for their market share to erode? Can you name a CEO in any business? I've traveled around and I've asked crowds, has anybody ever heard of a CEO saying something like that? And no, I have no examples. So like I said, this guy's weird. That's why I wrote the book. He's a unique dude. And the reason he said that is because he said, we're going to go cheap and our market share will go up, obviously, because we're best deal in town. But as we get others to get with the program, they're going to start to get market share and our market share will erode. And that's when I'll know that we have done like our mission, so to speak. So that's how big this guy's vision was. It wasn't just to build a company. It was to like reshape the whole enchilada from the inside out. And he did. I will say Vanguard's market share in the U.S. has not eroded. So we have this note we write called Bogle's Dream Not Yet Realized, because other firms, though, I will say, are doing better and better. I think 5, 6 years from now, we will see Vanguard have plateau, and that Bogle will probably, you know, would smile from the grave or whatever that he did it. But that's how this was said in 1991, by the way, before Vanguard even had much money. They were still like 2% market share back then. So he was that he knew they would take over, and then he knew they would take over too much. And then he knew other people would catch up, and then he knew the market share would erode. That's like a 30-year vision of exactly what's going to happen. Pretty whack stuff, right? It's like I said, there's so many little pieces like this that I, as an author and somebody just as a curious person, that I was able to sort of like unwrap and, you know, have fun with and explore, because I, in the end, I had to choose between two titles for this book, The Vanguard Effect and The Bogle Effect. And Vanguard is a much more popular name. More people know Vanguard in the US than Bogle by far. And if I called a Vanguard effect, I would have sold more books. But I feel as though after researching this, Bogle was a one of one. He's the anomaly. The company itself he created, but they could, mere mortals will run them. Ambitious, typical people could eventually run Vanguard like a normal company. And it's already starting to happen to a degree. They definitely go into spaces that Bogle would not. But I called it the Bogle effect because in the end of the day, he was the anomaly in physics. And he also spread a philosophy of low cost, which called the Bogle heads, a bunch of people who like carry his message, almost like a religious leader or something. And the Bogle heads will live on. So I just thought the Bogle effect was just more apropos for what I saw happened. And again, it was those kind of visions and statements that were just wildly, just weird, but speak to the impact that this one person had.
Absolutely. You said not ordinary CEO, weird, your words. And we're going to go later to look more about the pillars of what makes it so different. But as it's the tradition here, I want to show you a little clip. And this one is from Billions, who brings us to the office of a hedge fund, and they have what could be a typical Wall Street conversation.
Longs, shorts, sells, covers, all alpha welcome.
The choppy waters out there, perfect. For us, for the average investor, hell no. But never forget, what's bad for him is good for us. If we're as smart as we think we are, if not, the heat'll melt us like an almond joy in the sun.
So there's a lot to take in here, us and them. Alpha, not alpha. We're so smart and they're not.
Sure. One thing on that clip, which is interesting, is look, there's nothing wrong with competition. Obviously, they're trying to compete and get alpha. Their investors are demanding them outperformance. It's legal. It's fine. That said, it's the idea of like making money off of like the little people is they'll have to deal with that ethically. Like the way they put it is a little harsh. But everybody is out there trying to get alpha who's active, and that's their job. I don't condemn them in the book. And in the book, I say many times, look, I work at Bloomberg. These are our clients. We are downstream from this Bogle effect. It impacts us too in a negative way. But as an analyst, I'm telling you, this is a big deal. People should know about it. I'm always telling our clients, be ready for this. This is a big change. It's like, if you're in retail, I would tell you about Amazon. You've got to deal with this company. It's a big change in your industry. But it's amazing that this contrast with Bogle, who, again, wanted everyone to have lower fees and wanted the average investor to win. And in the process, there was a really interesting story in the book where in 1987, Bogle was giving a speech to the crew, and it was in December. And that was the same year the movie Wall Street came out with Gordon Gekko, famous movie, right? And that movie was like, greed is good. It inspired like a whole generation of people to come to Wall Street and make a ton of money, just like Billions. Those are the people who watched Wall Street and came to Wall Street, right? They had that motive. And then, meanwhile, Bogle is speaking to the crew and he's like, hey, look, this year we've lowered the fee 2 basis points. Our investors are getting a better deal. And it was amazing that the contrast of the greed is good speech with Bogle at his event in 1987. The culture changes. In the 80s, it was actually really fine to be greedy. Like that was the name of the game in the 80s. And in the 90s, there was a bull market. Cultures change. Things change. Bogle, laser beam straight the whole time. Like right through cultures, right through market cycles. Unwavering. If you look at his speeches, it's the same speech every year. And I found that interesting. He was immune to any shifts in cultures or cycles. And that was also interesting to me. Eventually, he won. He knew his vision was going to come true. And these guys, I think you watch that. Most investors, they look a little sad, to be honest with you, talking like that. Like he changed the way people even view that. It's not cool anymore. The passive thing, passive obviously is huge. Because at the end of the day, if you look at the returns that someone gets over, say, 30 years in an index fund that charges, say, 4 or 5 basis points, versus the hedge fund from Billions, you're going to crush that hedge fund. You're going to crush the active funds. As more time goes on, the index fund will beat more and more active managers. Because at the end of the day, it is very difficult to beat the market consistently. You can do it a year here, 2 years there, maybe even five. But to repeat that for the next five, almost impossible. The next five, almost impossible. Bogle goes through the numbers. The numbers are like one in like a million, basically, if you can outperform for 10, 20, 30 years. And then the idea of picking that person before, like, okay, so let's say one or two people can outperform over 15 years. Then it's like, well, who is that person now? Who could select that person out of, say, 10,000 active managers? So advisors and people can quickly come to the realization that, oh, the hell with that. I'll just go index funds and lock in outperforming 95% of managers over 20 years. That's an easy choice. And that's what people have done. So I will say, though, the index fund did not become popular until it got cheap. It was started its life at 65 basis points in 1976, but it was Vanguard's mutual ownership structure that was the crucial part of this. Because in the book, I claim that indexing got way too much credit for the index fund revolution. All of this is really about low cost. So over the years, Vanguard is a mutually owned company. So the investors have sort of delegates that go to the board and vote on their behalf. And what they vote for is lower fees because they're voting for the investors, not separate shareholders who want profits. This is really an important difference between most other companies. In fact, there is nobody who has copied their structure since, which is also interesting. So anyway, every time they got assets and they got a little extra money, instead of saying, hey, let's use that money to pay us more, the us is the investors. They're like, well, the way to pay us is to lower the fund fees. So every year, the fund fees go down a little. It isn't until like 2010, 2005, something like that, where they get below 20 basis points. And then they get below 10. That's when they start sweeping the country. So for the first 30 years, they got customers here and there. They were picking them off. It was one by one by one. It was really a grind. Because the expense ratio was still 40, 30, 25. It wasn't until like around of the financial crisis of 2008 where passive really went wild because the fees finally got low, really low, dirt cheap. And the active managers were unable to do anything to do better than the market decline in 2008. So a lot of people soured on active and the internet. The internet was really growing at that time, right? Everybody in around the mid-2000s was finally getting connected to the internet. So you had blogs and information just spread fast. So those three things, I think, collided in 2008-ish to make this hockey stick sense. So that's another crazy stat in the book is 97% of Vanguard's assets today came after Bogle stepped down as CEO. So that's also massively powerful because that tells you he toiled away in obscurity for 30 years, pretty much, fighting this, but he built a massive foundation. And that foundation allowed this huge skyscraper to grow, obviously. And it was a case of gradually, then suddenly. But those are some of the reasons that Vanguard was also an interesting story because this guy took the long road. Because the other thing is, if Vanguard didn't exist and indexing came along, I do believe there would be index funds. I just think they would charge 60, 70 basis points. They would never get that cheap. And let's say somebody came along and said, okay, let's like Schwab, let's do zero fee index funds. And they made it, and again, this is no Vanguard or Bogle in the scene. It's possible you would have a cheap index fund, but it wouldn't just be zero fee, it would be a loss leader. They would want you in the door so they could charge you with other stuff, right? Like a supermarket having like £2.99 per pound crab legs, something to get you in the door so you buy other stuff. Vanguard was unique because this was not a loss leader. This was slowly done over 40 years. So when you buy the fund at 4 basis points, that's it. There is no catch. There's no upsell. There's no other way they're going to take money from you. It's a Boy Scout 4 basis points, right? It's not a capitalist 4 basis points. It's a difference. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So that's why in the book, it was the long road of the slow grind to cheap was also part of the story. Because once they got cheap, it was cheap in a permanent way. It wasn't a gimmicky cheap. He could have taken a shortcut. And he purposely took the longer road over and over. And again, I could have done it. I go through his brain and I'm like, I would have done what most people do. I've probably taken as much money as I could, hired more people, sponsored a sports stadium. I would have gone wild like everybody else. That's human nature. That's why the book is on this guy and not them, though, or me.
Yeah, that's a fascinating. This long road is so interesting because when you look at it from a mathematical point of view today, or for people who have been through this journey, it seems so obvious. You might think, oh, but why does it take so long? But at the same time, as we say, oh, we're not easily entertained by the fact that someone tells us we lowered it by 2 basis points again this year. That's the big announcement compared to billions, compared to Wall Street that you named. And also, there's this idea, which I think it's really hard to grasp, is that so many people in the mutual fund industry, the investing industry, that are smart, that are putting so much effort into it, that's their job, that's what they do, do not outperform. And it took someone like Bogle, who's very convincing, to repeat the story year after year after year. Then it really started making, which is a fascinating entrepreneurial journey, personal journey, but almost a human adventure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I was a fund reporter early in the mid-90s, late 90s. That was my first job out of college. And Vanguard was part of the scene, but it was really Fidelity and T. Rowe. These were the... Yeah, you have to remember the 90s were really about who can be the five-star manager. And that person had like, they were like rock stars. People would go to barbecues and be like, I'm with the five-star manager. And that was the cool thing. Now people go to barbecues and brag about how little in fees they're paying. So again, it takes a long time to change the culture. And the big thing that Bogle did that I thought was a hard road was back in the 70s and 80s, again, for 30 years, most intermediaries, this would be the brokers and the advisors who sit between the funds and the people. They got paid based on a kickback from the mutual fund company called a distribution fee or a load. So they would say, okay, I'm going to invest in this fund because they pay me off, basically. It's like a bribe. I don't blame them. That's what the system was like that. Bogle in the 70s decided not to have any distribution fees. So that completely exiled him from the whole distribution system. So this is the equivalent of making a movie, right? Let's say you film this great movie, but you're only going to show it in your backyard. Like you will not play with it. You will not put it in any theaters. You're not going to give it to Netflix. You're not even going to put it on the internet. It's only going to be played in your backyard. And that's what he did. He made people have to come and find him in the backyard to get this great deal. So I also think by doing that, over time, he created the RIA movement because a lot of people at these big advisor brokerage platforms, wirehouses, they would hear Bogle speak or read about him. He wrote books. He was definitely a loud guy. And they go, I actually think this is the better way to go for my client. But they could not do it at the firm because Vanguard would not pay them to be on their platform. So they had to leave the big firm and set up an independent advisory service. And that, I think, was a huge part. So again, the impact, if you start to unpeel and look at, you know, these corners, you're like, wow, Bogle actually had a real hand in creating the RIA movement, which is huge in the rise of ETFs, in the rise of low cost and Vanguard. Because once an advisor gets a percentage of your assets, they're now shoulder to shoulder with you as investors. And of course they're gonna pick the cheap stuff because they're not dumb. Because they know the cheaper it is, the more it'll probably outperform, the better. It's like health foods. They're going to pick health food for you. But before this, they would get a kickback from the mutual fund company. So they didn't care that much what fund you were in because they needed to get paid off by the fund company. That is a major shift. So I always say, if you look around the world and you want to know, is Vanguard, ETFs, or passive going to grow here? I say you need two things. You need advisors that are beginning to get paid as a percentage of the assets, called fee-based advisor model. If you have that, you'll see a direct correlation with the rise of those other things. You also need a population that doesn't expect the government to fund its retirement. So the more people are moved to defined contribution plans and away from defined benefit, the population's going to get more savvy and they're going to be like, oh, screw that. I don't really want to pay all those fees in my fund. Or my advisor is getting paid the wrong way. They're going to start to become smart, ask questions, and they're going to find their way to the best deal. That's what's happened in the U.S. And so the percent, the advisors that are fee-based is now upwards of like 3/4 of the assets here. But in other parts of the world, it's really low. Could even be nothing, right? And so that movement is, I think, part of what we need, that we're going to probably have to see if ETFs or Vanguard or passive, those three things, are to have any kind of a hockey stick growth the way they are here. Australia is probably the most similar country. And you look at if all those three things are taking off there. So again, I studied this long and hard, but that's part of what made Bogle interesting was that decision not to pay intermediaries. That made you have to be outside the system. And it extended the length of time it would take Vanguard to grow by 20 years. Because again, you got to get people to actually leave the entire system, which is full of all the incentives. You got to leave that whole system, go on your own, and find your way to Vanguard. And they didn't do any advertising either. So again, that's how weird and unusual this story is.
Absolutely. And talking about the movement, there's another thing that I want to touch upon maybe briefly, is a bit more like the influence on behavior and also the philosophy. So there's ENAF, which is a thrift movement. You mentioned it in book, but for investors, there's also this concept of staying the course, right? Which if whoever's done it has done so well, keep buying and stay invested. And really, if you look at it performance-wise, especially today as we are the highest of the S&P 500, it's worked miracles, especially for those that came back during the crisis and stuff like that. So do you mind telling us a little bit about that as well and the impact of Bogle? Because I think eventually that also has a dramatic impact on, well, wealth building.
Yeah, so the idea of enough, that was more his philosophy, because I was asking myself in the book a lot, why did he do this? The story of why Vanguard set up, Bogle set up Vanguard was somewhat circumstantial, but he made the conscious decision to set up a company where all future profits were turned over to the customers. There were some circumstances involved. I won't go into the details, but if you read the book, you'll see how wild of a story that was. But at the end of the day, his brain had to set up a company like this, and he had to know that he would never become like Jeff Bezos rich, because obviously he would never be homeless either. He was going to get paid. But like I said, he gave up extreme riches, like billions and billions. He gave all that up because the company is not owned by him. There's no economic incentive to set up a company like this. But Bogle, his upbringing was very different. He lived both with no money and a lot of money as a kid. So he knew both sides. He worked since he was like 14 years old. He was a scholarship kid. He just caught the tail end of the Great Depression. And so he was thrifty by nature. His son said that he wore the same khakis for 40 years. He was like Buffett, I thought, in that way. Buffett like lives in the same house in Omaha, drinks Cherry Coke. A very like folksy guy, doesn't need a lot. Bogle and him were very similar, cut from the same cloth, which is ironic because one's the most famous active investor, the other's the most famous passive. But they were very much from the same, I guess, generation and mindset. And so generally that was one reason he did it. And then the idea of enough, he just was all about, that was also applied to just America in general. Over the 90s and 80s, he saw a lot of corporate America greed. Enron scandal. He wrote a whole book. After Enron, he wrote a whole book about corporate America's greed. You see his books. His books are called stuff like Battle for the Soul of Capitalism or Clash of the Cultures. It's like there's got these really, and some books are just like 300 pages of him ranting against corporate greed. He was cantankerous, but he really walked the walk with his company. It's one thing to lobby against something, but then you do the other. I see this with climate change a lot. We got to fight climate change, and then the person goes off in the private jet. You know what I mean? He walked the walk much more because his company was set up that way. And at the end of his life, he had $80 million in net worth, which is a massive amount of money. But if you set up the second, or actually the biggest U.S. fund company ever known to man, you would think that person would have much more. So he wouldn't even rank in the top 2,000 richest people in investing, even though he set up this massive company. So I think that's one of the things that I tried to unwrap from why he did that. But in terms of investors, the idea of figuring out the impact of costs on the final outcome. That's not so much an enough philosophy, but that's more of a just a what impact do fees have? And if you think about behavior and fees, they're linked. So in one book I called talk about the art of doing nothing. And this is something that is huge. Behavioral finance is a whole separate study that was born. And it was like, okay, why are investors dumb? Why do they chase funds when they're doing well and they leave when the fund underperforms? With those, though, that's buying high, selling low. It's the worst way to invest. But once somebody goes into a cheap index fund, a lot of times they're done. Their behavior is cured instantly because their mind is like, well, look, I get the market's going down, but what am I going to do? Jump ship from this really good deal to this one manager who's having a good run because they happen to be in value stocks or they're shorting the market. I know for a fact that this cycle is going to go like this. I don't need it. I'm sticking with my 3 basis point index fund. Thank you very much. I'll check back with the market in a year. So I call it the great resignation. By introducing a low-cost index fund, he cured the need to care. He cured the need to obsess. And so that's why when you look at down markets, the most disciplined investors are the passive ones. The money keeps coming in rain or shine. And I studied why. And the reason is just because they finally found something that they're getting married. That's essentially what happened. They're done the dating. They're no longer dating funds. They are married now and they're off the market. And so they never leave. And that is powerful. So in my opinion, the behavioral finance field has totally undercredited him with improving behavior across the board for anybody who finds this concept of a low-cost index fund. They are, because if you trade in and out of the market, it doesn't matter what your fees are, the behavior will destroy the fee savings. So if you can lock in good fee savings plus good behavior, you will beat even all the active managers, especially those billions knuckleheads.
I want to talk a bit about why people buy Vanguard and this question of branding in asset management. I think it's very clear, well, it's my point of view that, okay, it's very clear why I buy Vanguard anyway. Well, I can say it, why people buy Vanguard. It might not even be always the cheapest fund, but you pretty much know what you're getting, and it's going to be one of the cheapest, and there's this whole philosophy behind it, which means it's probably getting cheaper, versus from what I perceive, but obviously you might have a different point of view, and especially given your role at Bloomberg, a sea of funds, which all have their qualities and stuff, but from a retail perspective, very indiscriminate branding, except for one, which is another outsider on the other side of the spectrum, which is ARK Invested, which we know what they stand for, and they talk about this research, etc. They talk about Bitcoin going to, I don't know how much it is, aiming at 1 million. So very, very different, but they have a strong brand. So what's your view on the Vanguard brand and its branding in the fund space?
Yeah, so ARK is the polar opposite of Vanguard. Bitcoin is the polar opposite of Vanguard, but Bitcoin and ARK are fascinating because they're going to benefit from the rise of Vanguard. It's ironic. And I go into this in a chapter called The Fall and Rise of Active. What I contend in the book is that the more people, the Bogle had a profound effect on active management too. He is forcing active management to get cheaper, shiny. You can no longer mostly own the S&P 500 and charge 1% because now people can get the S&P 500 for free. So you have two choices here. You have to either get real competitive with the S&P and like basically lower your fees so you adjust your fee for the fact that beta is free, or you go the other direction and give something very unique. So I think portfolios have changed. Instead of stocking your core with like 2 or 3 hot active managers and then replacing them when they do bad, you've killed all that. Again, that's dating. You've now gotten married to a cheap index fund for your core. So your core is a 60-40 low-cost Vanguardian portfolio. Now, Bogle would say that's it. You should go home and just wait 50 years, you're good. But not everybody is as disciplined as him. Some people like to speculate and they don't want to have FOMO later on if something gets hot and interesting. They don't want to miss out. So there's a 10% of the portfolio that's dedicated for hot sauce. And this is just fun stuff that has nothing to do with the 60-40, because that's boring. You got to wait 30 years. So ARK has a 99% active share to the S&P. They invest in a lot of stuff that is very high growth, non-profitable. But her message is interesting. Look, these companies could change the world. What if she's right? Okay, I'll keep a little ARK because I don't want to feel FOMO if she's right that there's going to be robo-taxis and like automated surgeries and stuff. And Bitcoin, I don't understand it, but my kids understand it. I don't want to feel like a schmuck if it goes to $1 million. So I'll put 1% into Bitcoin. Plus, maybe it'll help my Sharpe ratio. So the hot sauce bucket is totally viable now. And the hot sauce bucket is a total byproduct of Bogle winning the argument over the core, which is ironic. So ARK's outflows were almost nil, even though the fund went down 80%. So it's perfect because you have more stomach for hot sauce because it's very volatile, because you've got the core covered with your serious investor stocks and low-cost Vanguard. So in a way, not only did Bogle help make the core cheap, but he actually helped investors get the intestinal fortitude to deal with very high speculative volatile investments as well, which people like to add as hot sauce. Because if Cathie Wood was the core of your portfolio and your kid's college fund was based on ARKK, there's no way you're going to stick in for an 80% downturn. There's no way. I'm sorry. Even though Cathie Wood, who I know well, is like, you don't need Vanguard, just go all in. The index has a bunch of like mall stocks, which are dying. I'm like, Cathie, nobody is going to put the money that matters all into ARK. It's just a fact. And so I tell Kathy, you should market yourself as a complement to Vanguard and not fight it, because I think you serve as a nice little complement. And so in a way, Bogle has made everything polarized. So you got to be cheap or shiny. Whether you're active or passive, you got to pick one of those lanes. The middle is in real trouble. But that makes sense to me, because at least if you're shiny, you're serving up something that's very different. And the shiny hot sauce area, you can charge more money. So that's why you see in the ETF area, a lot of the innovation in the US is pretty wild. Single stock ETFs, leverage ETFs, options-based ETFs. It's just stuff to sort of like, again, complement the cheap Vanguard core, and the issuers can charge more there. So of course they're gonna be more interested to like innovate there, because to try to fight Vanguard in the core is really hard, obviously. BlackRock does a pretty good job of it, so does Schwab, and even State Street. But all of them are just fighting over who's two basis points versus who's three. That's a tough fight to be in. So I also contend that this is actually good. That portfolio that I just gave you is how the whole industry is going to look. So like the asset management industry to me is going to look like the airlines, where there's three companies that have 75% of the assets. And then everyone else is like niche services, like Hawaiian Air, or Alaska Air, or private jets. I think that's how everything's gonna play out. So in us to get there, the next bear market, there'll be serious consolidation. So you're gonna see a lot of companies just get together, and there'll be like two or three, Vanguard will be one, probably BlackRock, maybe a couple of things they acquire, and then maybe State Street plus a couple they acquire. Those will be like this three mega asset management competitors. And then there'll be these things that compete for niche strategies where they can charge more, do specialty things. And frankly, innovation does happen more on the low, on the indie side, closer to the ground. The big three are not that good at innovating. So I think that's where we're going. And that's also part of the Bogle effect. Again, the whole industry is going to be changed now, but it will take a bear market, because even though everybody's gone to passive, the market has gone up so much that assets and active funds have held steady or even gone up in some cases, despite outflows, because the stocks they hold have doubled or tripled. So I call it the bull market subsidy. So the bull market has covered all this up. But at any other business, there had been massive consolidation already, because there is no such thing as another way to get assets, right? It's only the customers. But even though a lot of the customers have shifted and are now over in cheap stuff, the assets are still pretty big looking in the active funds. So a bear market is going to expose a lot of the Vanguard effect, and it's going to create like a real, just like I said, there will be a little blood. It's going to get pretty crazy. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think this model that Vanguard has introduced, active will be fine. It's evolving into smart beta, themes, cheap active, stuff like that. Active will live on, but it's going to have to deliver more value for those fees in the form of either lower fees or something that's a unique exposure. So again, this is why I wrote the book. It's not just, hey, this guy invented the index fund and look, all this. Index funds are only one chapter. Active is a chapter. Behavior is a chapter. Bogle, what went into making Bogle so unique is a chapter. So that's why I thought there was book potential beyond what people knew, because as a fund analyst, I'm constantly looking at flows and studying them. And every time we see flows move and shape, I'm like, God damn, if you pull the thread on this and you start just pulling and pulling, you end up in the same spot almost every time. You end up in the year 1974 inside this guy's brain and his decision to set up a mutually owned fund company. That's where the thread ends over and over. And so I just took all those threads and just played them out and then extrapolated how it's going to keep playing out. That's the book.
No, yeah, the book has so many, even for someone who knows Bogle, there's so much more to learn and so much details. And it's being a fan myself, I like to hear some minor contradictions, sometimes how difficult it must be to work with someone so obstinate. Let's have a little clip of Michael Jordan to compare the goats.
The most famous man on the planet is here.
My name is Michael Jordan. I played with the Bulls from 84 to 98. Took a 18-month vacation, hiatus. So I would say that's 13 years that I played with the Bulls.
So totally irrelevant to our conversations. But somehow, a goat, a single-mindedness, and also, how did he play with the Bulls for 13 years? I think you're a basketball fan. Is there any relevance here?
Yeah, sure. I think Michael Jordan playing with the same team is a real big part of why people consider him the GOAT. The Bulls sucked for the first like 7 years he was there. They always got bounced in the first round of the playoffs. He hung in there, lifted weights, got better teammates. There's something so much more admirable and heroic about standing your ground and building out versus jumping to a super team. That's why I think at the end of the day, Jordan will always overshadow LeBron. There's something more heroic and deeper about Jordan's path than LeBron's. But I do think Bogle was the GOAT of this industry, but in a different way. It's like Jordan was almost more like an active manager. You think Buffett, but Warren Buffett would be Michael Jordan. Bogle was almost like somebody who changed the entire game. He made everybody play differently.
I spoke to Greg Zuckerman, the author of The Man Who Sold the Market, and his answer of the GOAT was obviously Jim Simons, Renaissance Technologies. But Bogle has built his own category, right?
Yeah, it's funny. That book, The Man Who Solved the Market, I was almost going to call my book The Man Who Shrunk Wall Street, because I thought that it had a nice populist vibe and it played off well of that book. And the idea that a lot of people out there aren't just interested in low-cost funds. A lot of people think Wall Street is made way too much money, hedge funds make way too much money, and they would like to see somebody who shrunk it. And I thought that would play, but I ended up with the title I have, but that was one title I was playing with. But whether it's Jim Simons or Warren Buffett as Jordan, that's a debate people can have. In my opinion, Bogle, to me, was much more a combination of Steve Jobs and Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther King, but Martin Luther, the Protestant Revolution guy, because he made the products, first of all. So like Steve Jobs, he made the products. And like Steve Jobs, he would keep getting cheaper. Steve Jobs is famous for making the iPod have more memory, and it was smaller and cheaper. He would always evolve it and make it cheaper. And that's why Apple became so impossible to beat. And the flip side, he also developed a religion, and it was a protest. He basically put a sign on this door, on the church door of active management, saying, look, fees are the problem. And this was not something anybody wanted to hear. But over time, he developed a religion and philosophy about low-cost investing. And it's been carrying on by the Bogleheads. It's just like a religion. And they fight over Bogle-osophy, right? Some are real hardcore. Some are a little more relaxed, unique commodities. I went to one of the conferences. They debate this stuff. So just like the Protestant Reformation, there is definitely different forms of it that have spread over the years. In fact, some Bogleheads use Fidelity but just use all Fidelity funds in a very Boglehead manner. So the Boglehead thing is way bigger than Vanguard. It's all about low-cost philosophy. So those are my, I think he was a combo of those two people for this industry, more than, say, a Michael Jordan, because to me, Jordan was a player, and Bogle was more of a complete game changer versus one of the people playing the game. But I will, he's definitely GOAT-ish in terms of changing the game and building a behemoth asset manager. That's for sure. He's definitely in the conversation. He's just a little, he's different. He's unique to those other people.
I love how you embrace the GOAT thing with Jordan. I wasn't sure it was even going to work, but thank you, Eric. I would have so many more questions because it's such a fascinating story, but that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for this book. It's not a biography. It's many things at once. And what I like so much is that you can read it at so many levels, right? There's obviously this investment story, and there's the really personal story, this adventure of this man who embarked on the, well, Vanguard is the name of a boat, right, on a very long journey. And also all the little details that make it so palatable. Really an inspiring book, a great story.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the interest in the book. It's an interesting topic. That's why I spent, 2 years researching, writing it.